The annual Hajj pilgrimage is nearing its end in the holy city of Mecca as Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha. Iran says it's enriched uranium to a purity of 20% at Fordow facility using a cascade of advanced IR-6 centrifuges in a process reported to IAEA. And Khan returning to Sri Lanka's commercial capital, Colombo, following violent protests that forced both the president and the prime minister to resign. It's good to have you with us. Let's look at our top story. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims performing the final rituals of the Hajj pilgrimage in the Saudi city of Mecca. One of these rituals is tawaf, or circumambulation, walking around the Kaaba 7 times. Kaaba is a direction that Muslims always face while saying their prayers. And that ritual is the stoning of the devil, in which pilgrims threw pebbles at a rock, symbolizing the Satan. The rituals culminate in Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. On this day, animals are sacrificed to commemorate Prophet Abraham's decision to sacrifice his son in the name of God Almighty. Another essential part of the Hajj pilgrimage is the shaving of the head for men. Women will only cut the tips of their hair. Eid al-Adha is celebrated in Muslim countries around the world. The date varies by 1 day in different countries, depending on lunar sightings. Iranians are already marking the occasion. Now, on that note, I've talked to creative director of the Islamic Pulse, Muzaffar Haider, and asked him about the meaning behind the Hajj rituals and Eid al-Adha. Here's his take.
Eid al-Adha is that, precisely. It is a symbol of Muslim unity across the world, and in many ways, it shows the strength of the Muslims globally. It shows that Muslims have the ability to distance themselves, as Imam Khomeini has just recently spoken about, the Western culture, which is infiltrated into the Muslim households even. And what's happening is, throughout the past few years, indeed you could even argue the past few centuries, is an invasion by Western cultures. And what the efforts of the enemies of Islam have been, whether in the East or the West, is to divide and rule the Muslim lands, to attack the Muslims spiritually, mentally, and politically. Hajj is a reaffirmation of the strength of the Muslims to avert any kind of hostilities from the outside world. This is the revolutionary approach. This is where Imam Khomeini says that when we go to Hajj, we should actually disassociate ourselves and reject the Taghuti, or the tyrannical governments that exist in the world. These are, for the most part, elements of the Hajj, which are often overlooked. Many people, unfortunately, try to limit the Hajj and Eid al-Adha to just spirituality. But one of the most important points that we have to recognize is that every part of a human being's life, to a lesser or greater extent, is going to be affected by those who rule over us. And so what Eid al-Adha does, and subsequently what Eid al-Ghadir does coming up, is realign the focus. It makes us focus once again on the Taghut and on the evil governments of the world.
In other news, Iran saying it's enriched uranium to a purity of 20% using a cascade of advanced centrifuges it launched 2 weeks ago. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says that this was the final technical stage in the process. He said Iran had in advance informed the UN nuclear agency of its plan to inject uranium gas into a cluster of IR-6 centrifuges at the Fordow facility. According to Behrouz Kamalvendi, the Western media started hyping up the issue as soon as the International Atomic Energy Agency verified Iran's enrichment. On Saturday, Reuters cited an IAEA report which confirms Iran has increased enrichment using advanced machines. The news agency once again highlighted Western concerns about Iran's nuclear program, despite acknowledging that Iran had indeed informed the agency of its enrichment plan. Tehran says that Western tactics are only meant to pressure it at the ongoing talks aimed at removal of sanctions. Iran's president has once again pledged continued support for the anti-Israel resistance front, particularly Syria. Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran is for peace and stability and against any foreign intervention in Syria. In a phone call with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Raisi congratulated the Syrian government and the nation on the occasion of Eid al-Adha. The Iranian president hailed a recent visit to Tehran by President Assad and the good agreements that were reached by the two sides. The president called for efforts to follow through and implement the deals. Assad also noted that the enemies of the resistance front are growing weaker by the day. He said Iran and Syria are brothers in arms and wish the two nations increasing success at home and abroad. U.S. President Joe Biden defending his decision to visit Saudi Arabia and meet with its crown prince despite criticism that he's abandoning his stated concerns about a kingdom's human rights record. He's written an opinion piece for the Washington Post that his upcoming visit aims to boost strategic partnership with Riyadh. Biden says that the U.S. will use Saudi Arabia's vital energy resources to mitigate the impact of the war in Ukraine on global supplies, and that amid surging fuel costs and inflation at home. But the visit goes against Biden's repeated pledges to make Saudi Arabia pay for the killing and dismemberment of dissident journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. Biden's administration has released intelligence findings showing that Saudi Crown Prince MBS masterminded Khashoggi's murder. A voting is underway across Japan for the upper house of parliament, which is overshadowed by the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The vote is expected to expand the majority of Abe's ruling Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner. The party already enjoys a solid majority in parliament. The vote's taking place just 2 days after Abe was assassinated while on the campaign trail. The suspect is in custody and has told investigators that he targeted Abe because he believed that a politician was linked to an unnamed organization. Police chief in the area where Abe was killed has admitted that there were undeniable flaws in security for the former prime minister. Let's move on with the rest of this news broadcast. People in Argentina have taken to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest the agreement between the government of President Fernandez and the International Monetary Fund. Rallyers carried banners and placards that read, "Out with the IMF and no to paying the debt." They say the international financial institution brings them nothing but misery and dependency. Argentina recently reached a deal with the IMF to restructure a $44 billion bailout. The government says the agreement will not affect social spending, but opponents argue the deal largely burdens people. Last week, the economy minister resigned amid tensions on how to handle the economic crisis. Inflation in Argentina is running above 60%, while the South American country is experiencing a fall of its currency's values and an unstable financial market. Now, elsewhere in the world, it's the calm after a storm in Sri Lanka, where anti-government protesters are in celebratory mood, and that following the resignation of both the president and the prime minister. In capital Colombo, ralliers could still be seen milling around in President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence after storming it a day earlier. Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe's private home was also set on fire in a rare public display of fury. That was a dramatic escalation of a months-long public anger over the government's handling of a deepening economic crisis. The South Asian nation is facing chronic food and fuel shortages and a galloping inflation that hit a record of 54% in June. Despite the resignations, chaos is far from over. Details of a transition of power in the complexion of the next government are not clear yet. I was spoken to Chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Johan Pereira, as somebody who has personally taken part in the street rallies in Colombo. He talks about what it is that the Sri Lankan people actually demand.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time, that as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it, they are taking a swim, They're touring it. Hopefully they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful that, now there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
Now, over the past years, Israel has pressed ahead with its demolition campaign of Palestinian homes in the occupied territories without being held accountable. The regime is now planning to displace 1,200 Palestinians living in a dozen villages south of the West Bank under the pretext of building a military zone there. And that would lead to what is seen as the biggest mass eviction in decades on occupied land.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the forced Geneva Convention and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis.
Now, the 12 villages that Israel plans to demolish are located in the Masafer Yatta area, south of the West Bank city of Al-Khalil. The regime is forcing the Palestinian families living in that area to leave. And that would displace at least 1,200 Palestinians, including more than 500 children. The forced transfer has already been branded as a move in violation of international law.
The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it absolutely turned and chose that path, but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect, it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the 27-nation bloc and the UK will improve once Prime Minister Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements related to Northern Ireland. Jerome Hughes reports.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland.
The political developments do not change our position on the protocol or the way in which we work with our British counterparts on Northern Ireland. Our position is that we should endeavour to seek solutions on the implementation of the protocol, and that's it.
The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic.
The new Prime Minister will carry on more or less the same policy as Boris Johnson, with one difference that maybe he would be a bit more honest with the British citizen.
Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
وَنَادَيْنَاهُ أَنْ يَا إِبْرَاهِيمُ قَدْ صَدَّقْتَ الرُّؤْيَا إِنَّا كَذَلِكَ نَجْزِي الْمُحْسِنِينَ
And we called out to him, saying, O Ibrahim, you have indeed shown the truth of the vision. Surely thus do we reward the doers of good. Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, celebrates and honors the willingness of Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We Here at IRIB English Radio, congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. We witness how, cloaked in the shadows from the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away. Here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest. The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including National Security Agency Director and Chief of the United States Cyber Command, General Keith B. Alexander, co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of PayPal and Chief Facebook Investor, Peter Thiel, Executive Chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, Vice President, European Commission, Commissioner for Digital Agenda, Neely Crows, Chief Research and Strategy Officer, Microsoft Corporation, Craig J. Mundy, and many others. The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and The Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book, of the influence of the Bilderberg group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong, by the way. They didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come...
And don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And, look, it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired. But,
okay.
You know.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Right.
But there's no conspiracy in any of them.
No?
No, there's just a bunch of people.
How come you never hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions. But there's no meeting of the minds, particularly.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie-José Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie-José is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now-defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie-José Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended the secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario, Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick, Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia, Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta, Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper, Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO, Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at a Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but I, Bilderberg and Trilateral are not really think tanks. They're simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas. And they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their Executive Council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails. Do not release this information to the public. Do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. That's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings. Off the record, fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all government. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it. But seeing as, like, we have representatives in this House deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship.
When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore, you know. The average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
And everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media. It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew, an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brothers, or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them. and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You had thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video. You know, they're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world, to thousands of people, live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening, pretty much just through a cell phone. It's, you know, we're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest. It's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub. No, 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
That's a hard question.
It's a tough one. I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is, when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light. And they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you. But I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you, and we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty. And they will be defeated. And they know it. And they're starting to run scared. And they should be. Because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you all the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control. One way or another, people are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for an eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, this generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.
Well, in shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. But join me here next time for another documentary. Bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salamun Alaikum. So welcome to this part. We have a special story today. The name of this story is The Wolf and the House Dog. Yes, you are with the program Lantern. There was once a wolf who got very little to eat because the dogs of the village were so wide awake and watchful. He was really nothing but skin and bones, and it made him very downhearted to think of it. One night, this wolf happened to fall in with a fine fat house dog who had wandered a little too far from home. The wolf would gladly have eaten him then and there, but the house dog looked strong enough to leave his marks should we try it. So the wolf spoke very humbly to the dog, complimenting him on his fine appearance. "You can be as well fed as I am if you want to," replied the dog. "Leave the woods, there you live miserably. Why, you have to fight hard for every bite you get. Follow my example and you will get along beautifully." "What must I do?" asked the wolf. "Hardly anything," answered the house dog. "Chase people who carry cans, bark at beggars, and fawn on the people of the house. In return, you will get tidbits of every kind, chicken bones, choice bits of meat, sugar, cake, and much more beside, not to speak of kind words and curses." The wolf had such a beautiful vision of his coming happiness that he almost wept. But just then he noticed that the hair on the dog's neck was worn and the skin was chafed. "What is that on your neck?" "Nothing at all," replied the dog. "What, nothing? Oh, just a trifle. But please tell me. Perhaps you see the mark of the collar to which my chain is fastened." "What, a chain?" cried the wolf. "Don't you go wherever you please?" "Not always, but what's the difference?" replied the dog. "All the difference in the world. I don't care a rap for your feasts, and I wouldn't take all the tender young lambs in the world at that price." And always ran the wolf to the woods. There is nothing worth so much as liberty.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. Liberal-mindedness from the Islamic perspective. Next to the Holy Quran, we find that in Islamic hadiths, as issued by the infallibles, we find that this liberal-mindedness is asserted. There's a piece of hadith from the first infallible Imam, Al-Imam Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib al-Islam, in that he asserted it in this way, وَلَا تَكُنْ عَبْدَ غَيْرَكِ وَقَدْ جَعَلَكَ اللَّهُ حُرَّ. Never be the slave or servant of anybody else, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created you freeborn. At the same time, we find that according to Islamic instructions, nobody has any right to sell his or her liberal-mindedness, to sell his freedom to anybody else. And this kind of liberal-mindedness and freedom should make sense in the way of combating carnal desires. So long as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that nobody has any right to make oneself slave of other people, how would it be possible, how would it be interpreted or justified that someone would accept being slave of one's carnal desires or sexual lusts, for example? In this connection, we find that on the day of Ashura, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam asserted it in this way, أَلَا وَأَنَّ الدَّعِيَّ بْنَ الدَّعِيَّ قَدْ رَكَزَنِي بَيْنَ اثْنَتَيْنَ بَيْنَ السَّلَّةَ وَالذَّلَّ وَعِهَاتْ مِنَّ الذِّلَّةَ. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the day of Ashura indicated it that the illegitimate, that is Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, as the Umayyad ruler of Kufa, pressed Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam between two choices, between recognizing the Umayyad dynasty and between fighting. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam said that away is from us any indignation or any imposition. So we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam defended his own liberal-mindedness and freedom and never accepted being a slave of other people slave of other rulers. Then we find that Imam al-Hussein al-Islam defended his own self, and by the same token, Imam al-Hussein al-Islam defended the Islamic religion and showed it to the whole world the true price and true value of liberal-mindedness and freedom. From this perspective, we understand that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam indicated to everybody that there's no justification for being entangled and being enchained in the bonds of being associated with tyrants. So one of the basic meanings of the movement of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam was that people should respect their own liberal-mindedness and their own freedom. So one's freedom shouldn't be exchanged with anything else.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
By extension, one may find that one of the important aspects or consequences of liberal-mindedness and being free is that those people who are liberal-minded and free never sell their own freedom with anything else. According to a piece of hadith related from the 6th Infallible Imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, إِنَّ الْحُرُّهُرْ عَلَى جَمِيعَ حْوَالِهِ إِنَّ نَابَتْهُ نَائِبَةٌ صَبَرَ لَهَا وَإِنْ تَدَاكَتَ عَلَيْهِ الْمَصَائِبُ لَنْ تَكْسِرْهُ. A liberal-minded and a free person is free in all cases, in all situations. He withstands against unhappy currents of changes, and calamities cannot take him into pieces, cannot break him into pieces. In this connection, it must be indicated that the final supplications of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam is very much important on the day of Ashura. We find that on the day of Ashura, when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam received all sorts of problems and calamities, and he lost one by one all of his companions, even his newborn infant, we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam expressed his deep appreciation to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What does it mean? It means that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was very much liberal-minded. He was too steadfast to show any slight inclination toward the enemies. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam showed that even in the face of the harshest movements and the harshest currents of change, a liberal-mindedness may stay steadfast. And in this way, Imam al-Hussein al-Islam showed that people are expected to behave in the same way in order to value their own freedom and the freedom of their own community. From this perspective, we find that the only personality, the only sublime being who deserves worshipping and who deserves being worshipped is only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Those people who are associated with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and never associate this great sublimity with anybody else, they are, of course, true Muslims and true believers. Hence, we find that true believers are never slaves of their own carnal desires or any kind of satanic temptations. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, May Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.